Well, I don't know if you know where the prom started. Prom is actually short for promenade, and it was a promenade dance that was held at the end of the school year to honor seniors. Now, other students were allowed to participate, are allowed, but it's to honor especially those who are graduating from high school. And I know we have a number of young people here today who are, in a couple of months, going to graduate from high school. Can I ask, would you raise your hand if you're going to be graduating this year from high school? That's great. Congratulations. This is a really wonderful, exciting time for you. That's a fine accomplishment. And I know we all wish you well with your studies and with your future plans. Some of you are probably going into the work world, some going to university, college, trade school, work. When I was a student at Ambassador College a long time ago, I had the responsibility of planning for our graduation ball, which was kind of the equivalent of the prom. And I chose as our theme that year, Renaissance. You may know that Renaissance is a French word, and it is a period in history, the 1500s, that's the 16th century in Europe. It was called the Renaissance because there was a rebirth, that's what it means, Renaissance, it means rebirth. There was a rebirth of knowledge in Europe, and that was because the city of Constantinople, the Eastern Roman Empire, had fallen to the Turks, and all of the wise men, the educated people from Constantinople, they all moved west to get out from this invasion, and they ended up in Italy, most of them. And they brought with them lots and lots of works in Greek and in Latin, which had been lost in the Western Roman Empire. So these new texts, these ancient texts in Greek and Latin, came to the West, and so there was this explosion of new knowledge, knowledge that had been lost in the Western Roman Empire. There was a rebirth of learning and culture that started in Italy and then spread to France and Northern Europe and England and so on. That is the Renaissance. And I thought the Renaissance was an appropriate theme for graduation. It's a time of a new beginning, kind of a new birth. Finishing high school and later college does bring new beginnings for us. We move into the adult world more and more, and we move into the professional world more and more. In some ways, finishing high school and graduating means entering adulthood. You're getting close to the age of 18 when, in the eyes of the law, you are legally an adult. And you are beginning, or perhaps you've already begun, to make plans for your life. I know, having gone through it myself, this can be a little nerve-wracking, can be a little bit scary to realize you're going to have to start making decisions that are going to impact much of the rest of your life. It's hard on your parents as well, because up until this phase of your life, they've pretty much been able to protect you and watch out for you and keep you away from dangerous things and situations. Your parents are very much, they have that on their minds now. I'm going to have to start letting go. I'm going to have to start letting my young people make their own decisions. And that can be a scary thought for parents as well, because they really want the best for you. They want to protect you. And now they realize that period is kind of coming to an end or getting very close to it. They're starting to have to give you more and more freedom to make your own decisions. And that's a little scary for parents because, having been through it themselves, they realize not every decision you make is going to be a good one, and some of them will bring some, or can bring some, negative consequences as a result of that. So rather than tell you all about this myself, I'll let Cat Stevens do it. Let's play that song now.
Breathing, but if you wanna leave, take
are some of the thoughts that are going through your parents' minds right now. They know what the world can be like. They know the good things that it can offer us. They know the bad things that are out there as well. And they want you to be very careful as you plot the next portion of your life. I do think that song expresses what a lot of parents think and feel as they watch their children prepare to go off into the world. Turn, if you would, please, to Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Verse 9. Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verses 9 and 10. It says, "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these God will bring you into judgment." There are consequences as a result of the decisions that we make. "Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart, put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity." Now, it doesn't always seem that way when we're young. It seems like, you know, if I lived to 70 or 80, more people are living to 80 or more years, that's a long time out there. But if you talk to your parents or older people, people who've got some white hair, they'll tell you, "Oh man, that just goes by so fast. It's like I blinked and here I am." It's been said that inside of every old person, there's a young person wondering, "What happened?" I think a lot of us can identify with that. But this passage says that youth is a special and wonderful time. Most of us, I realize that there are exceptions, but most of us in our youth, we have health and energy. We can learn quickly. We have quick minds. Although, don't underestimate the worth of experience as compared to theoretical education. So these verses from Solomon say, be happy. Your youth is not a time for sorrow. Possibilities are immense. But also know that there are consequences for every action that we take. Every move we make, so to speak, brings a consequence. And that's the problem, is that if we're not careful, we can do things that seem like they're going to turn out well, and then they don't. The French philosopher Michel Foucault said, "People know what they do. Frequently, they know why they do what they do. But what they don't know is what they do does." In other words, consequences. We know what we do, we know why we're doing it, but we don't always know what the consequence is going to be down the road. That's why God has given us the Bible. The Bible explains to us what is going to have good side effects and what is not. Every action brings about a reaction. There are consequences for everything that we do. In the United States in particular, we have special blessings that most of the rest of the world does not have. You probably know that I spend a lot of my working time in Africa, as do some others here in the room. And I've seen teens and young adults who've never really been able to have much of an education because their parents weren't able to afford it. Costs around $100 to $150 a year to put a child through school. And sometimes parents don't have enough money to do that for all their children. Sometimes, when our daughters were young and we spent a summer in Ghana, they found out that families have to pick and choose which of their kids get to go to school. Usually it's the boys first, and the girls sometimes, if there's no money, they just don't get to go. My daughters found that to be extremely unfair, but that's what it is. A lot of people that are in Africa will never own a house, or if they do own a house, it'll be one they made themselves out of mud bricks. They'll never have real jobs, that is where you clock in and clock out and get a salary at the end of the 2 weeks or the month. Unemployment can be 70 or 80% in a lot of African countries. So they're just going to, the French call it system D, débrouillardise. Débrouillardise means to find your way out of the fog, literally. So they're just kind of hustling. And I know people in different countries who work all day so that they can have a meal at night. And if they don't manage to get enough food, enough money that day, they may go to bed hungry. I made the mistake one time when I was giving a Bible study in the Congo of offering everybody lunch so that we could have a Bible study after the morning service. And as soon as they had eaten, and boy did they eat this food, they all fell asleep because that was their daily routine, is after you eat, you go to bed. So we had to cancel the Bible study because everybody was just conked out and had eaten, and that was it. So I don't offer lunch anymore. Sometimes dinner, but not usually lunch. You have a longer life expectancy than many of the people in the world, especially in Africa, where life expectancy can be in the 50s or 60s, or sometimes even in the 40s. That's the average lifespan of a man in a lot of places in Africa. So unless there's an accident or a disease or something that happens in your life, you have a very good chance of seeing your grandchildren, as I am doing now. A lot of people in the world will not have that opportunity. Guys in Europe, young men of your ages approximately, they don't dream of having a car. They dream of having a motor scooter. That's about the best they can hope for in their teens. And a lot of people in Africa will never have any sort of motorized transportation in their whole lives. Salaries are lower, prices are higher, and so it goes. Now, I'm not trying to make you feel guilty. I hope nobody feels guilty about that. You don't need to. But what we should feel is thankfulness. We should be very thankful for the blessings that we have in the United States. Material blessings, educational blessings, opportunities, the fact that probably a lot of you already in your young years, you have a smartphone. That is out of reach for most of the people in the world as well. We should be very thankful for the blessings we have. And, okay, I'm going to say it, you should be thankful for your parents. Because although they're not perfect, they love you very much. And they have done their best throughout all of your youth to give you the best start in life that they can possibly give you. They believe it's their responsibility before God to do that. They've given you an understanding of what is right and wrong that a lot of young people don't receive today, as used to be the case. They have given you a sense of moral balance that you probably can't imagine not having. It's built into you now, and that's a precious, precious thing that fewer and fewer young people are receiving from their parents nowadays. So my question for you today, and we'll think about this together during the time of the sermon, what will you do with the blessings you have? What will you do with the blessings you have, with that wonderful head start? I'm going to encourage you during the time of the sermon today to take full advantage of the wonderful beginning that you have as you move forward in life. Let's start. I'm going to give you two examples from the Bible of young people. At least they started out when their story began, they were young, and we'll follow through to when they get a little bit older in life as well. But first, we're going to look at a young man who had an excellent start in life. He was given an incredible blessing by God from his youth, but he didn't really take advantage of it. He took it for granted, and it cost him dearly. Now, once we get done with this example, we'll look at a young person who used it well, the blessings that he'd been given. But let's start in Judges chapter 13. Judges chapter 13. Starting in verse 1, Judges 13, verse 1. Now, you probably remember that during the time of the judges, there was no king in Israel. There would be a judge who would not only render legal judgments, but he was kind of a warlord. He would lead the nation in war against enemies around it because there was this cycle. Israel would obey God. They'd be blessed. Then the next generation would return to idolatry, and they would be cursed. And the curse was usually they'd be subjugated by their neighbors. And then they would cry out to God and say, "We're coming back to you." And he'd raise up a judge who would free them from this oppression from their neighbors. So we're going to read about one of the judges here named Samson. Chapter 13, verse 1. "Again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. And the Philistines were pretty mean customers, as we're going to see as we go through parts of the story of Samson here. "There was a certain man from Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. The angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, 'Indeed, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now, therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drinks, and not to eat any unclean thing. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines.'" That was the mission that Samson was given before he was even conceived. You're going to conceive, you're going to have a son, and he's going to start delivering your people from the Philistines. Move down to verse 24, if you would, please. "So the woman bore a son and called his name Samson, and the child grew, and the Lord blessed him." So he started off with some special blessings, and of course the one we think about is his great strength, but he was probably given other gifts as well to make him a judge, where he could render legal decisions for the people of the nation. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Mahanah, Dan, between Zorah and Eshtaol. So there was something unusual going on with this young man. The Spirit of the Lord was beginning to work in him. There were fruit that you could see. This is not just an average Danite Israelite boy. God's working with him very powerfully. But chapter 14, verse 1, we see kind of an attitude that's going to plague Samson all through his life. Samson went down to Timnah, verse 1 of chapter 14, and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. God had given instructions, you're not supposed to marry foreign women. They'll turn your heart away from the Lord. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I've seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. She is hot. Now, therefore, get her for me. So he's giving instructions to his parents. I found the girl. This is the woman I want. Get her for me. He didn't ask any advice. What do you think? Would you like to meet her? Can I bring her over? None of that. Just, I want that one. And we're going to see that this is kind of Samson's attitude all the way through his life. Get her for me. Kind of selfish in the way he looks at things. Doesn't want any parental advice. And as we're going to see, it caused him a lot of problems. Hanging around with the wrong people, dating the wrong women, caused huge problems for Samson. Verse 4 now, let's continue on. His father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord that he was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines, for at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. God knew about Samson's wrong attitude, and he decided, okay, I can use this. God can use our weaknesses sometimes to perform his will. And so God said, okay, I'm going to let him go with this because it's going to lead him into conflict with the Philistines. And that's what I want him to do. So Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now, to his surprise, a young lion came up roaring against him. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as you would have torn apart a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father or mother what he had done. Now, at this point, the light bulb's got to be going on in Samson's mind. Like, wait, this is not normal for a man to be able to rip a lion apart like a young goat. I'm quite sure I could not rip apart a young goat myself. Maybe a raw chicken, I might be able to manage that. I think a goat's probably aiming a little bit too high. And certainly a lion. If you think about that, how do you go about ripping apart a young lion? The only way I can imagine doing that is grabbing it by both jaws and ripping it apart like that. Because if you're trying to rip his tail off, he's going to be mauling your leg, right? So you got to get the sharp stuff in your hands and get that out of the way. And that's what he was doing. So I would venture to say that probably Samson was almost as strong as Mr. Pennington was. Now, he should have noticed something here. You know, I'm going to digress for a moment and tell you a story when I had a close encounter with a lion in South Africa. So I was staying with a church member. He actually let me hunt on his property. And he was raising lions. So he had lions in chain link pens all around his house. And he put the siblings together because they won't kill each other. Siblings from different litters will fight and kill them. But all of his lions were in these chain link fence enclosures. And he told me, he said, you know, there's a lot of burglary going on in this neighborhood around here. And I know someday somebody's going to come in the dark. They're going to open up this chain link fence to try to get in my house. And they're going to have a really big surprise waiting for them on the other side. Well, anyway, one afternoon, I told the owner that I was going to go and take a walk on his farm. He said, sure, no problem. So I walked out. And I'm walking pretty far away from the house by this time. And I looked over to my left. And one of the lions had gotten out of the pen. He was off in his field about 200 to 300 yards away from me. And I looked over at him, and he looked over at me at the same time. And he started coming toward me. And I'm thinking, oh, boy. Now, the one thing you don't want to do with a lion is run. Because if you run, you're acting like prey. So he'll be on you for sure. So the only chance you got if you encounter a lion, you've got to stand there, not move, try to make yourself look as big as you can, and just stand your ground. In fact, we read that in the Bible, stand against the roaring lion. So I kept telling myself, okay, don't move. The lion's getting closer. He breaks into a trot. Then he breaks into a run. He's coming straight at me. And I'm just standing there telling him, repeating myself, don't move, don't run, don't turn. And he stopped about 5 feet in front of me and roared. And in spite of myself telling myself, don't move, I jumped back about 10 feet, I think. It was just more than I could do. But the lion didn't get me. And I'm convinced that there was God's protection. There was the fact that I didn't run. I stood my ground. I think that's what saved me. That and the electric fence in between us. Even with the electric fence there, I jumped. If you deal with a lion, and I have encountered lions many times in a vehicle, they're frightening. They are terrifying. And to imagine taking a lion by the jaws and just ripping his head apart, Samson had to understand there's something else going on here. This is not normal behavior to be able to do this. So he rips a lion's head apart. Let's continue on in verse 7 now. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. After some time, he returned to get her and turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. So he took some of it in his hands and went along eating. When he came to his father and mother, he gave some to them, and they also ate. But he did not tell them that he had taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. So his father went down to the woman, and Samson gave a feast there, for young men used to do so. And it was so, when they saw him, that they brought 30 companions to be with him. So 30 young Philistine guys are invited to this wedding meal that he's having. And it was so, when they saw him, that they brought 30 companions to be with him. And Samson said to them, let me pose a riddle to you, and if you can correctly solve and explain it to me within the 7 days of the feast, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. But if you cannot explain it to me, then you will give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. And they said to him, pose your riddle that we may hear it. So he said to them, out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. Now for 3 days they could not explain the riddle. So it came to pass on the seventh day that they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else, this gives you a window into the way the Philistines thought about things, or else we will burn you and your father's house with you, with fire. Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Is that not so? Then Samson's wife wept on him, and she said, you only hate me, you do not love me. You've posed a riddle to the sons of my people, but you've not explained it to me. And he said to her, look, I've not even explained it to my father or my mother. So now I should explain it to you. Now she wept on him the 7 days while their feast lasted. And it happened on the seventh day that he told her, because she pressed him so much. Then she explained the riddle to the sons of her people. So the men of the city said to him on the seventh day, before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion? And he said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. You cheated. You got it from my wife. Then, he's motivated now. Now the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of their men, took their apparel, and gave the changes of clothing to those who'd explained the riddle. So his anger was aroused, and he went back to his father's house. And look at verse 20. She's betrothed to Samson, but Samson's wife was given to his companion who'd been his best man. So this girl he really, really wanted, they're married, but he goes home because he's angry about what's going on. And they immediately give her in marriage to someone else, the man who had been his best man. Samson now has started doing what God wanted him to do, but he wasn't doing it for the right reason. He wasn't saying, you know, God's will is for me to liberate the people. I've got to start getting everybody organized, and we're going to kick the Philistines out. We're going to get out from under them. He's thinking about himself and women and bets. And, you know, it's just accidentally decided, okay, I got to kill 30 Philistines so I can win, so I can pay off this debt. Now we go on a little bit farther. So she's given to his best man. Chapter 15, verse 1. After a while, in the time of the wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. And he said, let me go into my wife, into her room. But her father would not permit him to go in. Her father said, I really thought that you thoroughly hated her. Therefore, I gave him to your companion. But I have another daughter. You can have her if you want. Is not her younger sister better than she? Please take her instead. So we see here Samson's got very bad taste in friends and in female companionship. This was not an upstanding woman. She accepts just to go with the next guy. Okay, he's mad, he's left, I'll go with this guy. She's sleeping with his best man now. She's gorgeous. She's beautiful. But she's not faithful. Kind of sleazy, actually, if you think about it. The Philistines had morals a lot like our 21st century. That's the way they were living at the time. Verse 6. Let's go to verse 4. Verse 3. Samson said to them, "This time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them." They play dirty pool. I'm going to get them now. So he's beginning to do what God wanted him to do, but not for the right reasons. Samson went out and caught 300 foxes. Again, think he should have noticed that something was kind of unusual. Have you ever caught a fox? I've never caught a fox. 300 foxes? How long does that take you to do that? He caught 300 foxes. He took torches and turned the foxes tail to tail, put a torch between each pair of tails. When he had set the torches on fire, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and burned up both the shocks and the standing grain, as well as the vineyards and olive groves. Then the Philistines said, "Who has done this?" And they answered, "Solomon, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion." So the Philistines came and burned her and her father with fire. Don't make friends with the Philistines. There are Philistines out there in the world today, too, who will act like that and treat you like that. Pick your friends carefully. Pick your friends very, very carefully. He's getting obvious help from God. Samson said to them, verse 7, Samson said to them, "Since you would do a thing like this, I will surely take revenge on you. After that, I will see." So he attacked them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. Then he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock at Etam. That should have just been getting warmed up. No, he took revenge, then he went home. Okay, I'm going to go do something else now. I'm more interested in other things. Chapter 16, verse 1. Then Samson went to Gaza, and he saw a harlot there, and he went into her. Now, he knows better than this. This is really sleazy behavior on the part of Samson. Going to a prostitute? That's what he did. He knew better than that. But apparently he had an attitude of, I can do whatever I want. Who's going to stop me? I mean, if I can kill a lion with my bare hands, who's going to mess with me? I can do whatever I want. As I said, he didn't set about organizing a resistance to the Philistines, organizing an army to fight them, to free his people. He lived his own life as he pleased, for his own pleasure. And as we're reading here, about the only time he really did something that was according to God's will was when it happened accidentally. God had to kind of set him up to get him to do what he was supposed to do. Verse 4, afterwards it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. And we all know how this is going to end. He should have married a girl from Israel who had the same moral framework that he was supposed to have. But he was enticed by these beautiful foreign women who were going to lead him down a very wrong path. She wore him down. Verse 18. When Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she did the same thing. Wept on him. "Oh, you don't love me. Tell me the secret. Why are you so strong?" She wore him down. Then she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, "Come up once more, for he has told me all his heart." So the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hand. Then she lulled him to sleep on her knees and called for the man and had him shave off the 7 locks on his head. Then she began to torment him. She didn't love Samson. She didn't love him at all. He was just a tool to be used in her hands. And all he could see was how beautiful she was. Beauty does not equate to goodness. Separate things. Now, there can be very nice, good, beautiful women. I married one. You've got that combination. But one does not guarantee the other. And that's the way a lot of people think in the world. If you're beautiful, it's got to be good. No, not necessarily. Then she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson," verse 20. So he woke from his sleep and he said, "I will go out as before at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. His hair was gone and with it his strength. And the Philistines took, keep going into the Philippines here. The Philistines took him and put out his eyes and they brought him down to Gaza. They bound him with bronze fetters and he became a grinder in the prison. However, the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. Be careful with whom you get romantically involved. It will change your life incredibly, more than you can probably imagine right now, either for better or possibly for worse. So that's an extremely important decision that we make. So the last thing Samson saw was probably a hot poker pulled out of a fire and brought close enough to his eye to damage it and make him blind. And that was the last thing that he saw. And he was made to be a grinder. So he's probably pushing some sort of wheel, maybe like Conan the Barbarian, you know, he's on the wheel of pain. Maybe it was something like that. He's just pushing a wheel to grind the grain. What an incredible fall from the strength and the power that he had previously. Verse 23 now. Now the lords of the Philistines gathered together to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. And they said, "Our God has delivered into our hands Samson, our enemy." Boy, were they wrong about that. Then the people saw him, they praised their gods, for they said, "Our God has delivered into our hands our enemy, the destroyer of our land, and the one who multiplied our dead." And Samson had to listen to that all the time. So it happened when their hearts were merry that they said, "Call for Samson that he may perform for us." So they called for Samson from the prison and he performed for them. I don't know what that performance was. Something to amuse them? Did he dance a little jig? Did he, probably some kind of dancing that he had to do or some, I mean, how humiliating would that be? Blind and having to perform for your enemies. He performed for them and they stationed him between the pillars. Then Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, "Let me feel the pillars which support the temple so that I can lean on them." Now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. In fact, there were about 3,000 men and women on the roof who watched while Samson performed. So it was probably an open courtyard in the middle of this building. They're up lining the roof and they're watching down in the courtyard while Samson is performing. Then Samson called to the Lord, saying, "O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes." You know, he may never really have completely understood what he was supposed to be doing. He didn't say, "Let me take vengeance on the Philistines and free my people." He said, "No, they put my eyes out. I want to kill them. They did this to me." Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple. He braced himself against them, one on his right and the other on his left. And Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." And he pushed with all his might, and the temple fell, and the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead that he killed at this death were more than he had killed in his life. Again, God's will was fulfilled. It happened. And God can make things like that happen in anybody's life. But Samson had to be sort of cajoled into doing what God wanted him to do. He could have just set out to do it, but that's not what happened. He may never really have gotten the point. God's plan would be accomplished, but he did it the hard way. He did it the hard way because of his approach to life. "I don't need any advice. I can do whatever I want. I'm going to live the way I want." He took his advantages and he used them for himself. To put it in today's terms, he lived to partay. That's what he wanted to do. Bring on the wine, women, and song. He got in with the wrong crowd. And it cost him his eyes and his life. People die of wrong decisions, poor habits, even today. There was a young actor named River Phoenix, who probably none of you remember because he's been dead for quite a long time now. But he had a very great, promising career as an actor in front of him. He died of substance abuse. I read just recently that his younger brother, Joaquin Phoenix, who's acted in movies like Gladiator and more recently Napoleon, he was there with him when he died, and he was cradling his brother in his arms, and his brother's last words were, "Promise me you won't live like I have done. Promise me." And then he died. And Joaquin Phoenix is on record as saying his brother's death saved his life because he was living the same way. He was going down a road that was going to kill him. Bad decisions in life, bad habits in life will cost you, just like good decisions will pay off big. And I've observed from afar some of the people that I graduated from high school with. Some of them have very successful careers, work in Washington, D.C., in think tanks and things like that. Others died young from drinking and driving, from substance abuse. Some of them have good marriages that have lasted. A lot of them have been divorced multiple times. They're not happy in their marriages. Some of them have spent time in prison. Some of them may still be in prison for all I know. So, part one, hang on to what you have. Use the advantages and the blessings you have wisely. Get good advice. And I'll talk a little bit more about where we can get good advice about life. But now, let's turn the page on that sad example, and let's take a happy example now. Let's talk about King David. King David was chosen to be king at a very young age. So young, in fact, that nobody in the family thought that was possible. What, you're taking the runt of the litter? You're going to make him the king? And but that's what happened. 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel chapter 17. Starting in verse 1. Samuel 17 verse 1. The Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered together at Soko, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Soko, Azekah, and Ephes Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. We can know pretty closely where the battle of David and Goliath happened. The valley of Elah is pretty small, and there's only one brook going through the middle of it. That would have been where David picked out his five stones. So I had the chance to walk around there. It's very thought-provoking when you can visit some of these locations. Okay, you know the story, so I'm just going to pick out a couple of verses here and there. Let's go down to verse 25. So Goliath is out defying the armies of Israel, defying the God of Israel every day, and he's such a big guy, nobody wants to tangle with him. The men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he's come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption in Israel." So these soldiers don't really have the best attitude either. They're not saying, we need to remove this reproach from Israel. He's cursing the God of Israel. They say, man, if anybody could kill Goliath, he gets to marry the king's daughter, he's going to get rich, and he'll never pay taxes again. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Especially around this time of the year when we're filling out our tax returns and settling all of that. We could get rich. But David has a different attitude. Verse 26. David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills a Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" That's where David's focus was, like we heard in the sermonette. His focus was, these are the armies of the living God. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine to cast reproach on the people of God? He was very God-centered. He was God-centered. Okay, let's go a little farther now. Chapter 18, verse 12. Chapter 18, verse 12. Now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but he had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence, made him a captain over 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Now we have a thoughtful young man. He may still have been a teenager, and he has a command of a contingent of 1,000 soldiers. And the king is afraid of him because he's wise and he behaves well. And the king knows that God's not with him anymore, but everybody can see that God is with David. And that's because of the way he lived his life and the choices he made, and the fact that he maintained a relationship with God through prayer. Therefore, when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. So he's taking his 1,000 guys out and they're coming back in bloody and their armor is dented and dinged, but they're bringing back victory. And the people loved to see David come back in with his troops. And Saul got more and more nervous about it because he didn't know what to do. He didn't want to lose the throne. 1 Samuel 24, verse 1. This is when Saul finally has a psychotic episode and tries to kill David, and he has to flee. He flees with some of his men, and they're out in the wilderness. So chapter 24, verse 1. Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told to him, saying, take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. En-Gedi's a really interesting place to visit as well. There's a spring that comes up out of it. All kinds of caves all around that you can see as you go up this gorge. I've been there a couple of times. It's a national park now. And they bottle the water that comes up out of the spring, and you can buy it in the supermarket. It's a really interesting place to visit. There's a lot of wildlife there. So Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel, and he went to seek David and his men in the rocks of the wild goats. And there are still wild goats that live there to this day. So he came to the sheepfold by the road, and there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs. So this is a restroom stop. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. They're all the way in the back of the cave. Saul comes in and squats down. You know, he's taking care of business. Then the men of David said to him, David, this is the day which the Lord has said, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hands. You can do whatever you want to him. God's put him in your hands. David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe, and he said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. He felt really bad about being disrespectful to the king, even the king who was trying to kill him. But David's idea was, he's the anointed of the Lord. If God wants to remove him, he can do that anytime. And even though he's trying to kill me, I owe him respect because of the position that God has given him. He had a very tender conscience, and it bothered him here that he had done this thing. So that is another clue about David's character and the way he saw the world. He was a man that lived by principles, not by desires and emotions. Although he wasn't perfect in this, we know about his sin with Bathsheba. So he had his moments of weakness as well. But let's look at 2 Samuel chapter 5. 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 12. So David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he exalted his kingdom for his people's Israel's sake. David felt that responsibility very strongly. I am king. God has made me king so that I can serve the people of God. And that was what he had in his mind. He wanted to give his life in service for the people over whom God had established him. He made mistakes, big mistakes, as we all have done or will do, but he always repented. He sincerely repented when he was corrected. And he spent his life seeking to properly and correctly use the blessings that God had given him. Let me open another little parenthetical thought here. Anything, any talents that we have, anything that we're good at, we really shouldn't be proud of that, because those are just things that God gave us. If you're good at whatever, if you're handsome or pretty, God gave that to you. You didn't do anything to deserve that. If you're strong, like Mr. Pennington, well, I guess he did a little bit there. Worked out a little bit. But if you've got a quick mind, you're good at music, God gave that to you. That's just loaned to you by God. So we really shouldn't be proud. Now, if we've worked really hard to develop something, there's a proper pride that we can do when we concentrate it. But everything we have comes from God. Just a gift from God. He wanted to use his blessings correctly, David did, in order to honor God. And as a result of that, God said that he was a man after his own heart. Now, you got to think about that for a moment, because David committed adultery, then he committed murder. But when he was corrected, he repented abjectly, and he never did that again. He learned his lesson. Now, in those days, kings had absolute right of life or death over any of their subjects. So David was within his right, according to the way people viewed things at the time, to have somebody executed if he wanted to. But of course, that's not the way God viewed it. And David repented and corrected himself. God said of David, he doesn't take for granted what I have given to him. He doesn't use it selfishly for himself. He uses it to honor me and to serve my people. That's Acts 13, verse 22. If you want to put it in your notes, that's where he said, he's a man after my own heart, who will do all my will. God saw that in David. Let's look in Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3. If I could give you one bit of advice in preparing to go out into the world and make your way, learn the Proverbs well. Concentrated little nuggets of wisdom that will guide you into wise decisions. This is a book that was written specifically for people in your age group to give you the best start in life that you can have. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 1. My son, see, it's written to young people. Do not forget my law, but let your heart keep my commands. For length of days and long life and peace will they will add to you. Let not mercy and truth forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablets of your heart. And so find favor and high esteem in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil, and it will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones. Honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase. So your barns will be filled with plenty, and your vats will overflow with new wine. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor detest his correction. For whom the Lord loves, he corrects, just as a father the son in whom he delights. Happy is the man who finds wisdom, and the man who gains understanding. For her proceeds are better than the profits of silver, and her gain than fine gold. She, wisdom, is more precious than rubies, and all the things you may desire cannot compare with her. Length of days is in her right hand, and in her left hand riches and honor. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who take hold of her, and happy are all those who retain her. So, if you want to have a successful life, get wisdom. Learn to be wise. A lot of people don't do that. But in the Proverbs, the book of Proverbs, you're going to find a lot of practical stuff. Practical tools on how to succeed in your life. And these things will make you popular with God, but with people also. They'll make you popular with people. They will allow you to make the most of the good things that you've been given. Use those good things that you've been given. Think about them. Be aware of them. Go far. Succeed in your life. Proverbs 22, verse 3. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 3. A prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. Simple, sometimes in the Proverbs, is kind of like ignorant or stupid or not paying attention. And that's what it means here. A prudent man foresees the evil and hides himself. So the way I imagine this, you can have your own image in your own mind. I don't know why, but I think of Lord of the Rings. And I see the hobbits walking down the road. The ringwraiths are coming toward them. And one of the hobbits says, "Oh, ringwraith." And they hide themselves, right? And the ringwraith goes on by, doesn't see them. The simple hobbit is walking down the road, not paying attention. Doop-de-doop-doop-doop. Splat. Because he wasn't paying attention. So we want to be very aware of what's going on around us. We want to be very alert to possible dangers that are coming down the road to us. This is what Cat Stevens was singing about. It's a wild world. I hope you have good things, but a lot of bad things happen out there too. So be aware of what can strike you. Don't let that happen to you. Somebody said, nowadays, modern times, most brains are suffering from chronic unemployment. Somebody else said, if you've tried your hand at something and failed, the next best thing is to try your head. You've heard these things before. I know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but we do need to be reminded periodically. Even as adults, we need to be reminded periodically of these things. Your parents know lots of people who are grown up physically, but still very immature emotionally and in their minds. Another smart guy said, we don't all think alike. In fact, we don't all think. There's truth in that. Now, let me mention a couple of concrete places where you can get wisdom. I encourage you to write these down. Places to get wisdom and what to do and what not to do in life. Where can you get steered the right way? Number one, your parents. You can count on your parents to give you the best advice that they can. They won't try to manipulate you. They won't try to trick you into doing what they want you to do. They'll give you the best, most honest advice that they can. And you can trust them, which is not something you can say about everybody in the world, and probably some of your acquaintances. Some of them will give you advice to try to get you to do what they want you to do, not what's going to be best for you. You'll be able to trust your parents. Sometimes they will give you advice that you're not going to like. You want them to say something else, but they'll tell you what they really honestly believe is best for you. And you should think about that very carefully. Sometimes some parents even repeat themselves. And I know young people really don't like that. You already told me that. Well, give me some indication that you heard what I said, and I'll move on to something else. So let them know if you've heard them, and they probably won't repeat themselves so much. Second place you can go to get excellent advice every time, the Bible. The Bible. Study, as I said, study the Proverbs in particular. When I was a kid, our parents made us memorize Proverbs. I don't know if any of you have had to memorize Proverbs, but I had to memorize a whole bunch of Proverbs when I was in grade school. And some of them I remember very well to this day. That's actually a pretty good exercise, although we don't memorize stuff very much anymore because we've got phones on our hips or in our pockets and we can just call it up. But it's a mental development and discipline to memorize some things. And I believe one of the most important things we can memorize are Proverbs in the Bible that are so important. Study the Proverbs, very practical in life. Study stories like we've been doing today. What lessons can we learn from Samson? What lessons can we learn from David? What lessons can we learn from Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the 12 sons of Jacob, etc.? There are lessons to be learned from all of that. The kings, good and bad. The great women of the Bible, Sarah, Ruth, Esther. What can we learn from their lives? Lots of things. I would encourage you also to be observant of the people around you. Observe events that are happening in other people's minds. And keep the long term in mind. You may see some people that are advanced in age, maybe in their 50s and 60s, and they've got their lives together. Think about why. How did they get to be that way? You will see some people of the same age whose lives are not together at all. Why? What decisions or what habits did they have that led them to, you know, a chaotic end of their life? We should be observant to things like this. And remember that the bad results sometimes take years. Decisions are a little bit like boomerangs. I don't know if any of you have ever tried a boomerang before, but you throw a boomerang, if you do it right, which I never really quite learned to do, and it'll go up there and it'll hang for a while. And then eventually it'll come back to you again. Decisions are like that. And you can throw good boomerangs or you can throw bad boomerangs in your youth. And sometimes it will take years before it comes back to you. And sometimes there are people that get up in years and they're just walking along. Wham! What was that? Well, it was a boomerang you threw 20 years ago. It's just coming back now. And sometimes good things will happen when you didn't expect them to happen. It takes a while. We have to think in the long term. Learn from what happens to people you know. Also learn from people you don't know. By that, I mean read biographies. That's a very good way to get wisdom about life. Read lives of great and successful people, what they had to do in order to succeed and be memorable to us. You can even learn from people who had evil lives. Kaiser Wilhelm II, what a monstrous man he was. Don't be like him. Hitler, Mao, Lenin, evil people. But there are also wonderful examples that are inspiring and encouraging to us. The Queens Elizabeth I and II of England, Marie Curie, Luann Johnson. I know if you know the story of Luann Johnson, she wrote a book called My Posse Don't Do Homework, turned into a movie called Dangerous Minds. She's a fantastic example of a teacher. Golda Meir, Prime Minister of Israel. Indira Gandhi in India. Margaret Thatcher, Madeleine Albright, Sandra Day O'Connor, Condoleezza Rice. There are lots of examples of brilliant, successful women out there that can be very encouraging. And for men, although I've read some of those biographies of the women as well and have learned from them, we got people like George Washington without whom this country probably wouldn't exist. He was the, I have a biography of him called The Indispensable Man. If George Washington had not been on the scene, we probably wouldn't have gained our independence from England. The founding fathers, Jefferson, Hamilton, Abraham Lincoln, U.S. Grant, Theodore Roosevelt. You want to get stirred up and excited about life, read Theodore Roosevelt's life. That man was unbelievable, just incredible. Winston Churchill, George Patton, Dwight Eisenhower, Norman Schwarzkopf, Colin Powell, Herbert Armstrong. I encourage you all to get a copy, borrow a copy if you have to, of Mr. Armstrong's autobiography. It's a fascinating story, and those are our spiritual roots in this era of the Church of God. Everybody in the church should read that at least once. And think about your life. Meditate. Concentrated thought on your life. Get facts before you make decisions. Get advice. But all the time knowing that you will be responsible for the results that happen in your life. Keep God involved. Ask for His wisdom. Pray to Him and ask Him. When you have a big decision coming up, go to God and ask Him about it. I don't know which door I'm supposed to go through. Some doors are trap doors. And we can't always tell the difference without some extra help. Well, young people, you're getting ready to embark on a great adventure. The adventure of your life. You have a big head start over about 99.99% of young people in the world, both physically, educationally, and in principles for good living. Take advantage of those advantages. Don't squander them. It's a wild world. A lot of good things turn bad out there. But if you do it right, a lot of very, very good things can and will happen to you. So I always try to have at least one French sentence in my sermons. Bon voyage.